Good day. Today is Wednesday, 25th February 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If, once you've watched this programme, you decide that you like what you have heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, today I'm going to discuss three topics. I'm going to discuss, firstly, the things that President Trump said in his State of the Union address about Iran and about the likely prospect of an American attack on Iran and the limits on US capabilities. And then I'm going to discuss the situation in Ukraine, or at least the conflict in Ukraine, in light of certain comments, especially made by President Putin at a meeting of Russia's counterintelligence agency, the FSB. And then I'm going to finish by returning to British politics, and I'm going to discuss the latest revelations in the Epstein-Mandelson scandal and the various steps that the Prime Minister Keir Starmer appears to be taking in order to preserve his position as head of the British government. Let me start first with President Trump and his State of the Union address and the whole situation with Iran. Now, I am not going to discuss the domestic part of the State of the Union address in this programme. What I will say very briefly about it is that in tone and form, it actually reminded me quite a lot of the State of the Union addresses that President Trump's predecessor, Joe Biden, used to make. They were all, just as Biden's addresses were highly partisan, so was Trump's. Just as Biden's addresses were extremely self-laudatory, so was Trump's. There was the same very selective and often misleading citation of statistics, which I suspect many people in the United States will find meaningless and detached from their everyday realities. In fairness, there are differences in objectives and policies, but nonetheless, overall, I was struck more by the similarity. It was the president's comments about Iran that stood out for me, and which I admit I found concerning, and which make me sure that, in fact, in his own mind, he has now made a decision to launch an attack on Iran, and that we are basically only, it's only a question of time before it happens. Anyway, this is what the president says. As president, I will make peace wherever I can, but I will never hesitate to confront threats to America wherever we must. That's why in a breakthrough operation last June, the United States military obliterated Iran's nuclear weapons program with an attack on Iranian soil known as Operation Midnight Hammer. For decades, it has been the policy of the United States never to allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. Many decades since they seized control of that proud nation 47 years ago, the regime and its murderous proxies have spread nothing but terrorism and death and hate. They've killed and maimed thousands of American service members and even millions of people with what's called roadside bombs. They were the kings of the roadside bomb. And we took out Soleimani. I did that during my first term. It had a huge impact. He was the father of the roadside bomb. And just over the last couple of months, with the protests, they've killed at least, it looks like, 32,000 protesters. 32,000 protesters in their own country. They shot them and hung them. We stopped them from hanging a lot of them with the threat of serious violence, But this is some terrible people. They've already developed missiles that can threaten Europe and our bases overseas, and they're working to build missiles that will soon reach the United States of America. After Midnight Hammer, they were warned to make no further attempts to rebuild their weapons program, in particular nuclear weapons, yet they continue. They're starting it all over. We wiped it out and they want to start over again and are at this moment again pursuing their sinister ambitions. We are in negotiations with them. They want to make a deal, but we haven't heard those secret words, we will never have a nuclear weapon. My preference is to solve this problem through diplomacy. But one thing is certain, I will never allow the world's number one sponsor of terror, which they are by far, to have a nuclear weapon. Can't let that happen. Now, these are extraordinary words. I'm going to say straight away that virtually every actual substantive claim that the president makes here, I find, well, either wrong or fantastically wrong. I mean, the president seems to say that the Iranians might have killed millions of people with roadside bombs. I mean, that is an astonishing claim, and I've never heard anybody make that kind of claim before. He claims that it was the Iranians who invented roadside bombs or were the first people to use them on a large scale. That, as any person who's been familiar with the history of war, even the kind of cursory knowledge of the history of war that I have, knows that that is nonsense, and that the United States was developing bombs itself that could be called roadside bombs, and that they were used in Vietnam. And of course, the United States was not the first country to do that by any means. Many others did that as well. He claims, without any corroboration, that 32,000 protesters were killed in the recent protests in Iran on the Duran's Substack site. I republished an article I wrote 13 years ago, 15 years ago, following the conflict in Libya, in which I pointed out that the numbers of protesters supposed to have been killed by the Libyan government during the protests in Libya in 2011 was subsequently found to be many times inflated. And I've no doubt at all that the same thing is true in the case of Iran. He claims that Iran is in the process of developing intercontinental ballistic missiles that would be capable of attacking the continental United States, and that they are in a position to do that soon. Again, no evidence provided. As far as I know, that is an allegation that no one has ever made before. And of course, having repeatedly told us after the attack on Iran in June that the United States had obliterated Iran's entire nuclear program, he says that Iran is busy reconstituting it and that it is clearly intended eventually to result in Iran acquiring a nuclear weapons capability. Now, that last point is, of course, contradicted by the US intelligence community. They have been reporting consistently since the mid-2000s that Iran has no nuclear weapons program. Back in the spring of last year, shortly before the US attack on Iran in June 2025, the US intelligence community again reported that Iran does not have an active, ongoing nuclear weapons program. And to cap it all, The president then goes on to say that the United States, he has not heard from the Iranians those supposedly secret words that Iran does not ever intend to acquire a nuclear device, a nuclear weapon. As, well, I'll say it, Ray McGovern pointed out to me in a private email just a short time ago, the Iranians have been saying that publicly, repeatedly, incessantly, continuously for at least the last 20 years, probably longer. And Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, has actually issued a religious decree, a fatwa, saying that possession of nuclear weapons, or at any that rate their use, is contrary to Islamic law. So this is such an extraordinary tissue of misrepresentations, lies if you prefer, that even for this president, I have to say it left me gasping. But look at the other words the president uses. He talks about the Iranian leaders being terrible people, that they have sinister intentions, that they seized control of this proud nation 47 years ago. It's difficult to avoid the conclusion, reading or listening to all of those words, that this president, Donald Trump, absolutely detests, loathes the present government of Iran, is determined to see it gone, does not consider it legitimate, and frankly, after listening and reading these words, I can't myself doubt that whether it happens sooner or later, some kind of an attack on Iran is bound to happen whilst this particular president is in office. Now, on that issue, we have had further information about the military situation, about the military balance. And the first thing to say is that yesterday, Reuters, the British news agency, published a report that China has agreed to supply Iran with $500 million of advanced supersonic anti-ship missiles of a sort that the Chinese Navy itself uses and which could be used to attack carriers. They have the range and the capability to attack carriers. And the missile in question is the C-302 missile. Now, I've looked at pictures and information about this missile, the C-302. As a number of people have pointed out, it appears to be a derivative of the Soviet Moskit missile, which the Soviets, or rather the Russians, sold to China along with Sovremeny class destroyers about 20 years ago, from my memory. The Chinese apparently were very impressed by the capabilities of what was at that time this very advanced supersonic cruise missile. They were impressed by its accuracy and its capability, and they've clearly taken that missile as a starting point. We must assume it is an absolute certainty that whatever new missile the Chinese have developed on the basis of what was already a formidable missile, the Moskit, will be a far more powerful, far more advanced, far more dangerous missile altogether. So this delivery of these missiles to Iran would be a major game changer, I suspect, in terms of naval operations against Iran. Having said this, reading that report in Reuters, it appears that this is a relatively new agreement. It almost certainly would take quite a lot of time, a year at least, maybe, before these missiles are incorporated in the Chinese, in the Iranian military system. I doubt that they can have any immediate bearing on the current crisis. However, there have been two extremely interesting reports which I have read, which do have a direct bearing on the current crisis. One is a very detailed report provided by the CSIS, the Center for the Center for Strategic and International Studies in the United States. Now, the CSIS is widely known to be the think tank of the US military-industrial complex. And I won't say that their commentaries are always right, they're far from the case, but in this case, I cannot imagine that the CSIS would have any motive to downplay the capability of the US forces currently deployed against Iran. Nonetheless, that is exactly what this report does. And it is, by the way, written by a US military officer, retired military officer. And it's clearly a very well-researched report. And it makes the same point, as many others have done, that the objective that the president is setting, or appears to want to set, in terms of what this force can actually achieve, is at the moment very nebulous. But this report says that though this is a major deployment of US forces against Iran, it is nowhere near enough. It in no way compares with the far bigger deployments that took place on the occasion of the first Iraq war, the first Iraq war of 1991, or the second Iraq war of 2003. There's minimal numbers of ground forces. There don't appear to be large numbers of special forces deployed in the area either. And though there is a significant amount of aviation and naval firepower, the capabilities are not the same as was deployed by the United States in either 1991 or 2003 against Iraq. It is comparable instead to the forces that were deployed against Iraq, against Saddam Hussein's government during Operation Desert Fox in 1998. Now, I remember Operation Desert Fox extremely well. It was an event which triggered significant protest in the international community, just to say. It triggered the first instance I can remember of Russia and China working together against the United States in the Security Council. Bear in mind that in 1998, Boris Yeltsin was still Russia's president, just saying. But the point about Operation Desert Fox, as this report in the CSIS says, the point about Desert Fox is that the United States could only sustain it for 4 days, 70 hours to be precise, and eventually the whole operation had to finish because there weren't the means to continue it for any longer. And at the end of that operation, Saddam Hussein's government was still in control of Iraq. So if we compare the situation in 1998 in Iraq with the situation today in Iran, we see why a operation Desert Fox like, an operation like Desert Fox, on the face of it, should have little to no prospect of success, no ability to achieve regime change, or, as the CSIS report says, no ability to do any substantive long-term damage, and, by the way, it also says no ability to achieve regime change. Because what failed against Iraq in 1998 would now be attempted against a country, Iran, which is many, many times bigger than Iraq. It's a population. It has a population of 90 million. It has a vastly bigger territory. It has a far larger, far more dispersed, far more resilient industrial and manufacturing complex. And, of course, it has a much more decentralized government and power structure than Iraq did in 1998. So, on that reading, not only should an attack like Desert Fox on Iran now be less effective or ineffective, Desert Fox failed to change Saddam Hussein's policies and did not lead to his overthrow. But it should be actually less effective than that, significantly less effective than that, because Iran is much bigger, much more powerful, far more resilient. The only factor that might conceivably play in favour of this operation, were it ever launched, is that, of course, in 1998, Saddam Hussein and his security forces had tight and complete control of Iraqi society, whereas today in Iran, that does not seem to be the case. But again, that is not, to my mind, a reason to think that what failed with Iraq in 1998 could succeed this time against Iran. Now, Larry Johnson has also provided his own analysis of the situation, and he's provided some more technical details. He's pointed to the limited range of the American stealth fighter jets, most of which are based now in Jordan. He's pointed out that the Chinese radar systems that Iran is believed to have received would be able to provide Iran early warning of the movement of these stealth fighter jets, which would materially assist Iran's air defense system, and that all of that might work together to reduce the abilities of any strike carried out by the United States against Iran. Of course, all of this presumes that Iran has indeed received this very advanced Chinese radar system, and that Iran has also received advanced surface-to-air missile systems from China and perhaps also from Russia. We have no absolute definite confirmation that this is the case, but in terms of the supply of the Chinese radar system, for the record, I think it probably is the case. Anyway, there it is. The president has been advised by his military and intelligence officials that this is a very bad idea. The CSIS is now saying that the forces available are not sufficient, not remotely sufficient, to achieve the objectives that the president appears to want. They would not be able to destroy Iran's nuclear enrichment capabilities, they would not be able to defeat its ballistic missiles. They would not be able by themselves to achieve regime change in Iran. But we see that the president appears to have intense feelings about Iran. He is constantly being told by all sorts of people that Iran represents some kind of enormous threat and is being encouraged to attack Iran by all of those people who, like neocons, always pay little attention to the realities and are instead, as far as I can see, very heavily invested in the belief that America has essentially limitless power and the ability to do whatever it likes. And I have to say that I don't think the president is in any mood to listen to warnings from people like General Kane or Director Radcliffe or J.D. Vance or Tulsi Gabbard, which many reports claim they are, those two people are also giving. Nor do I believe that the president is reading reports from the CSIS. All of the evidence is based on his own words that at some point within the next couple of days, the next few weeks, he will take the plunge, he will order the attacks to begin, and then of course we will see where we will see whether, despite all of these warnings, despite all of these problems with capabilities, his truly colossal gamble pays off, or whether instead it all ends in humiliation and disaster. Now, I'm going to return briefly to the CSIS report because it goes beyond, well beyond, just discussing the potential for an attack on Iran, because it actually gives a very interesting overview, or so it seems to me, of the actual state of the US armed forces. It speaks about the enormous concentration, or rather the enormous proportion of force that the United States has deployed in the area of the Arabian Sea. It talks about how these forces consist of 49 Navy ships, the United States has currently 29 Navy ships at sea conducting operations, of which 20 are in or around the Middle East. 41% of Navy ships that are ready for military operations are in the Middle East. And the enormous concentration of air power in the Middle East as well, and of the fact that there is really very little more that the United States can do to commit forces, additional forces, to the Middle East in any short-term timetable, using any kind of short-term timetable. Much of the American fleet, most of the American fleet, it's over 200 vessels, 200 ships altogether. As I said, only 49 of them are operating. All of the others are in bases, undergoing various levels of maintenance and repair. There's been reports that the Gerald Ford, the second aircraft carrier that has been deployed to the region, and which is now in the Eastern Mediterranean, has had maintenance issues. There's said to be problems with sewage on the ship. It's apparently had to dock at a US naval base or arrive at a US naval base in order to sort out these problems before it can join or participate in other military operations. The Ford has been deployed for many months now and apparently is starting to suffer issues of wear and tear. Now, all of that is consistent with what I remember from 1991 and 2003, which is that it took the United States many, many months to assemble the forces it needed to conduct an operation against Iraq. It looks as if it would take the United States at least that many months in order to be able to deploy forces against Iran sufficient to achieve or have any real prospect of achieving any of the president's objectives. And here perhaps I would say that I'm not sure that the United States is in a position to do that anymore. It looks to me as if the logistic and maintenance challenges today are greater than they were in 1991 and in 2003. In 1991, the US military was the US military of the Cold War. There were still vast numbers of men in uniform. The Navy was bigger then than it is today. I get the sense that the logistics and supplies and repair and maintenance facilities in the United States itself functioned at a much higher level than they do today. If we compare with the British military of that era, 1991, and the British military of today, we see a colossal shrinkage and a huge reduction in capabilities. The British, I seem to remember, deployed two divisions, or at least two divisions, to Kuwait in 1991, a very substantial force. And though the force that was deployed in 2003 by the British was smaller, it was still a significant one. I don't think anybody in London believes that Britain has the capabilities to do the same today. The United States clearly is in better shape, but I suspect that much of the same shrinkage, much of the same decline in capability has happened, has affected the United States military as well. So what took months to do in 1991 and 2003 might conceivably today be, if not beyond the US's reach, certainly much more difficult to do today than it was possible then. Whereas the other side is getting stronger. We have the C-302 missiles that the Chinese are supplying to Iran. And bear in mind, we have that information from Reuters. There is the talk about the radar. There are the air defense systems. There's all sorts of things going on. Iraq in 1991 and 2003, and by the way, during Desert Fox in 1998, did not have that kind of assistance. Iran potentially does. The balance of power in the Middle East, the balance of military power in the Middle East is shifting. And it is not shifting in America's favour, despite claims, various claims that you see in other places. And lastly, if it takes 40% of America's fleet, a deployable fleet, to confront Iran, does the United States actually have a fleet big enough to take on China in the Asia Pacific, let alone China and Russia together. Just saying. Now, this then leads me to the next point, which is also about yet another report. This time it's a report that's come out in Britain, and it's a report from the Institute of Strategic International Strategic Studies, Chatham House, as it's sometimes called, and they regularly publish something that they call the military balance, and they've been doing this for as long as I can remember. They were doing this well back in the Cold War, as I remember very well at that time. Anyway, they talk about the critically poor capabilities of the British military. They compare the supposed failure of British rearmament. Well, actually, I should correct that, the actual failure of British rearmament with the supposed success of German rearmament. In fact, and in reality, there's been no German rearmament. Germany's spending an awful lot of money on defence at the moment. But the Germans themselves are saying that the state of their military is deteriorating, not improving. And for example, they are completely out of air defence missiles. Just saying. But this report from the Institute of International Strategic Studies talks about the steady, enormous build-up that is taking place in Russia, how Russia has 5,000 tanks, 520 fighter jets, how its military is continuing to grow in size. And the report specifically says that despite all of the other pressures, the economic pressures, the military pressures, all the claims about losses in Ukraine, all of those things, Russia will have no difficulty sustaining its war effort in Ukraine in the area of the special military operation throughout 2026. The military balance in Europe continues to shift in Russia's favour, and in terms of the war in Ukraine, if you read the report carefully, it's clear that the balance is shifting in Russia's favour on the Ukrainian battlefields as well. Exactly, by the way, as the operations chief of Russia's general staff, General Sergei Rutskoy, recently said. So, there it is. I mention all of this because over the last few days, we've had an absolute flood of entirely predictable and essentially identical articles proliferating right across the British and European media, all saying that the war is in stalemate, that Ukraine is showing incredible resilience, that the Russians are suffering incredible losses, that it is untrue, false to say that the Russians are winning the war. Some of these articles, in fact, all of them actually, have all of these same, I call them heartless cliches, almost gloating, as far as I can see, in the massively inflated figures that they are circulating about Russian losses in Ukraine. All of them making similarly heartless cliches about the strong morale and resilience of the Ukrainian people, which is contradicted by reports and commentaries coming from Ukraine itself and from statements made by Ukrainian political figures like the mayor of Kiev, Vitali Klitschko and by other Ukrainians, such as Zelensky's former press officer, Yulia Mendel, and Zelensky's former spin doctor, Arestovich, just saying. But anyway, we have to accept all of this. This deluge, as I said, of commentary, of articles are being made. But anybody who reads this report from the Institute of Strategic Studies, I have to say, if they took a deep breath and they put their own feelings aside, I think they would see the realities. That just as the balance of power realities, balance of military power realities in Europe are tilting in Russia's favour, so by necessary extension, they are tilting in Russia's favour on the battlefields of Ukraine itself. Now, over the last few hours, we've had a whole series of comments from the Russians, but we've also had some rather strange indications from the Americans. The first thing to say is that President Trump, even as he was making all of these incredibly belligerent, indeed ferocious comments about Iran over the course of his State of the Union address, had over the course of that same State of the Union address very little to say about Ukraine at all. He talked extensively about his peacemaking efforts. He continued to insist, for example, that it was he who achieved the ceasefire between India and Pakistan, and that the Indian Prime Minister owed his survival to President Trump's ability to broker and achieve that ceasefire. India continues to be extremely frustrated and indignant about this. But anyway, there it is. But over the course of Trump praising himself for his successful peace efforts around the world, he spoke about his continued efforts to achieve peace in Ukraine. And that was basically all that he said. He did slip out that the level of losses in Ukraine in any one month is 25,000. He didn't say who was suffering those losses. The implication seemed to be that it was both sides. I would just quickly say that though I have no reason to believe that President Trump is well informed about losses in Ukraine, the figure that he has just given, 25,000, presumably for the losses suffered by both armies, is significantly below the 30 to 35,000 casualties that all of these articles at the start of the special, that I've been talking about in Europe have been claiming Russia has been losing every month. Just saying. Anyway, that was all he said. He basically said that the United States is trying to settle this conflict and that he himself is trying to settle this conflict. And that was all. In fact, the United States has been doing other things. It abstained from a resolution in the General Assembly, which Ukraine proposed on the anniversary of the special military operation, and which was backed by the European powers, which restated much of the condemnation of Russia that we have seen. Now, the first of these resolutions was actually published, was actually voted on by the UN General Assembly in February 2022, shortly after the special military operation started. Even then, it was noticeable that many of the very big powers, like China and India, for example, were abstaining. Since then, all energy behind this resolution has drained away. It still carries just about, but one gets the sense that there's a complete lack of conviction behind it. I noticed that many of Russia's friends, China, India, obviously Iran, but Saudi Arabia also, they all abstained in relation to this resolution this time. But anyway, the Europeans voted for it, the Ukrainians voted for it, it still got through. There was a large number of abstentions, a certain number of countries voted against it, Russia, of course, voted against it, but critically the United States abstained. The reports say that the US ambassador to the United Nations, who is, by the way, Mike Waltz, who is a neocon, a very, very strong anti-Iran and pro-Israel neocon. Anyway, he was not happy with the text of the resolution. He wanted it to be divided up into a group of separate resolutions rather than voted on as a single resolution. The Ukrainians refused. They insisted on putting it to the vote in the traditional form agreed by Ukraine and the Europeans, and the Americans decided in that case that they would not support it and they abstained. Now this, of course, deprives this resolution of any meaning. All the great powers, the United States, Russia, China, India, Brazil, either voted against the resolution or abstained. And that, in effect, renders it empty and meaningless. This came shortly after the US sent only low-level officials to attend the meeting in Kiev of the Ukrainians and the Europeans, which was held to commemorate the start of the special military operation. So the Americans essentially stayed away from that meeting as well. So one perhaps ought not to read too much into this. The United States still continues to impose sanctions on Russia. It still provides Ukraine with intelligence assistance. It still allows the Europeans to buy weapons in the United States, which they then ship on to Ukraine. These diplomatic steps perhaps have a token quality rather than an actual quality. But sometimes symbolism does matter. And I can't imagine that Zelensky and the team around him have any doubt any longer that the United States, at least this administration, even as it becomes obsessively focused on Iran and seems to be gearing up for a very ill-thought-out clash against that country, is losing interest and fervour on the topic of Ukraine. And by the way, I get the sense that that is true in the United States altogether. Even the Democrats don't seem to be talking about Ukraine as much as they once did. Anyway, I just mention all of that because, well, it's probably not critically important, but it might have some importance in the longer term. In the meantime, President Putin himself has now weighed in and he has given a very, very interesting speech address to the Russian counterintelligence agency, the FSB, which has had the annual meeting of its board, its collegium, as it used to be referred to in Russia. It had its annual meeting yesterday. And the meeting, judging from Putin's words, was mostly about the dirty war. And Putin had an awful lot to say about the dirty war. Firstly, from what I could see, Putin at least was to some extent distancing himself from the claims about nuclear weapons deliveries by Britain and France to Ukraine. This is what he said, and I don't think these words have been reported properly. The adversary does not shy away from using other means. Reports have appeared in the media about their attempts or plans to use some kind of nuclear component. They should know how that may end. Now, Dmitry Medvedev, the vice chairman of the Security Council and head of Russia's military industrial commission, has made it fairly clear that if Russia gets the sense that Ukraine is indeed being armed with nuclear weapons, the Russians will treat that as a critical threat, and they will use all available means, which of course means includes nuclear weapons, to ensure that Ukraine does not acquire them. And here we see Putin essentially hinting at the same thing. They should know how that may end. Putin is saying that if Britain and France do entertain any ideas of supplying nuclear weapons to Ukraine, the Russians are ready. They will respond with overwhelming force, and that overwhelming force may extend to the use of nuclear weapons themselves. However, Putin is not saying that Britain and France are indeed planning to supply nuclear weapons to Ukraine. What he is saying is that there are media reports that that is what Britain and France might be planning to do. Reports have appeared in the media about their attempts or plans to use some kind of a nuclear component. Now, of course, Putin is being very circumspect here, because the media took those reports from Russia's intelligence agency, the SVR. And any report that the SVR prepares on an issue like this will, of course, have been communicated first and foremost to the president of Russia, who is also the chair of the Security Council, who is, of course, Putin himself. So Putin will have seen this report, and the SVR itself will have briefed him. The fact that he's saying that this report does not come from the SVR, but is something that is appearing in the media strongly suggests to me that, rather like myself, he doesn't quite believe that the British and the French are really intending to do such an incredibly dangerous and very crazy thing. Now, these comments of Putin's about nuclear weapons deliveries to Ukraine have distracted attention away from the far more interesting things that Putin said. First of all, Putin discussed at length how Ukraine is indeed engaging in a terrorist campaign, or a dirty war campaign inside Russia, how it extends to sabotage and assassinations, how Ukraine is not doing all of this by itself, but is getting help and assistance from his Western sponsors. How the worse the situation for Ukraine becomes on the battlefronts, the more Ukraine seems determined to conduct operations of this kind in inside Russia itself. He also said that one of the purposes of these operations is clearly to provoke the Russians into abandoning or jeopardizing the talks that have been taking place at the present time between the Russians, the Ukrainians, and the Americans. Now that, it seems to me, must refer to the recent assassination attempt on General Alexeyev, one of the deputy heads of Russia's military intelligence agency, and possibly one of the negotiators at the talks between the Russians, the Americans, and the Ukrainians in Abu Dhabi. Putin's words here suggest to me that someone in Russia perhaps said to Putin, look, the Ukrainians are attacking the senior man in our intelligence agencies who was the deputy of our number two negotiator, who is the deputy of our number two negotiator, Admiral Kostyakov, who led the negotiations in Abu Dhabi. How can we continue to conduct negotiations with the Ukrainians and the Americans whilst such a thing happens? And Putin is saying over the course of this speech, if we walk out from the negotiations and the talks, we are doing exactly what the Ukrainians want us to do. This is a provocation intended to achieve exactly that outcome, and we should not fall for it. That, at least, is my construction of these words of Putin. It doesn't mean that he intends to take a softer line or that he is retreating from any Russian position. But what he's basically saying is that it's the Ukrainians who are unhappy with these negotiations. They don't like the direction these negotiations are taking. They don't like the things that we are saying over the course of the negotiations. The negotiations play to our strengths and are to our advantage, and we should not let ourselves be provoked by the Ukrainians into walking out of them, however extreme that provocation might be. I suggested that there is some kind of discussion going on in Moscow in many programs now. It seems to me that these words of Putin, which I accept, do require interpretation, and this is my interpretation of them. Anyway, that is what they suggest. But Putin also says something else. He said that the Ukrainians are planning to conduct attacks against the Turk Stream and Blue Stream pipelines in the Black Sea. The pipelines that supply gas to Turkey and, I believe, to southern Europe as well. And this is what he said. Our operational information should also now be carried by the media. It should probably be out today. Perhaps it already is. I did not have a chance to check. It concerns a possible explosion targeting our gas pipeline systems, Turk Stream and Blue Stream pipelines, along the floor of the Black Sea. They simply cannot back down. They do not know what else they can do to undermine this peaceful process aimed at settlement through diplomatic means. They are doing everything possible to stage a provocation and to derail everything that has been, let us put it carefully, achieved at this negotiation track. We will discuss this further behind closed doors. So compare this with what Putin said about the delivery of a nuclear weapon by Britain and France to Ukraine. He said that all of this information is in the media. He didn't say anything about Putin himself having received a briefing about it from the SVR. Here, he is saying the opposite. He is saying that he, Putin, has received a briefing about a planned attack by Ukraine on the Turk Stream and Blue Stream pipelines along the floor of the Black Sea. Our operational information should now be carried by the media. So this is the other way round. This is information that Putin has received directly from Russia's intelligence agencies and which he is now publicly confirming. Just as there was an attack on the Nord Stream pipelines, I'm not going to discuss here who was involved in carrying out that attack. So now, according to Putin, an attack against the Turk Stream and Blue Stream pipelines in the Black Sea is also being prepared. This isn't a case of newspaper reporting or newspaper gossip, however well informed that might be. This is actually based on intelligence about which Putin himself has been briefed. And he says that he's going to discuss all of this, including the actual state of the negotiations, behind closed doors with the leadership of the FSB. So, well, we see that the dirty war is underway. We see that Putin is highlighting increasingly extreme steps that the Ukrainians are taking. And by the way, much of his address was dedicated to the many, many steps the Russians are taking to tighten up internal security in order to combat what the Ukrainians are doing inside Russia in connection with their dirty war. Now, I think I have discussed in an earlier video, in a report that I read, I think it was a Radovka, about why the Russians are much more circumspect in carrying out their own dirty war operations, assassinations, sabotage, and that sort of thing inside Ukraine itself. Apparently, they've been contacted by all sorts of people in Ukraine, people disgruntled and disillusioned by the Zelensky government, or in many cases actively hostile to it. There have been many reports from these people saying that they're prepared to engage in partisan activities against the Ukrainian government, against its military, against its defence installations. And the instructions that have been coming from Moscow is do no such thing. Under no circumstances, do anything like that. What we want you to do is not to put yourself at risk and to compromise whatever organization you might have by engaging in sabotage attacks and assassinations, which will expose you and might lead to your liquidation by the Ukrainians and by their Western backers. What we need you to do is to preserve your organization, whatever it is, so that it can provide us with information and intelligence about what is going on in Ukraine behind Ukrainian lines. And that is entirely classic spycraft, I should say. But I would also add that it is also plausibly because the Russians might be looking at these organizations or groups that are starting to emerge in Ukraine and may be saying to themselves that one of the reasons why we need to preserve them and the people who make them up is because if we have to advance westwards, we might need the help and cooperation of these people in order to establish power structures, administrative structures in Ukraine, which are completely independent and have no connection to the existing power structures in Kiev, which are not only untrustworthy, but abhorrent to the Russians. So anyway, it's an interesting speech. It gives a clear insight into Putin's mood. He's determined not to be thrown off course or be provoked. He's expecting at some point an attack on the Blue Stream and Turk Stream pipelines. And he's almost certainly informed Erdogan and the Turks about this. But even as he is insisting that steps be taken to secure Russia itself against more dirty war operations, and I've discussed in a recent program how the tightening of control on Telegram is unquestionably part of this. Incidentally, on that, I should say that I noticed that Medvedev and most of the Russian ministries and all of the Russian bloggers and the Russian Ministry of Defense itself still continue to use Telegram to provide us with information about the state of the military operation. Anyway, all of this, as Putin says, is part of the tightening of internal security that has been ordered in Russia following recent events, perhaps the major trigger being the assassination attempt on Alexeyev. Anyway, there it is. The other thing to say is that the Putin who spoke at this meeting came across to me as a very confident man. He certainly gave me the impression that he believes that Russia is winning the war and that it is in fact going to win this war. And well, I don't really feel I need to add anything further to that. Now, there's been more information from the battlefronts. I'll be very brief. The Russians, after the news from Zaporozhye yesterday, where the Russians continue to advance, today we've had lots of information from Konstantinovka. Not only is there apparently an operational crisis for some of the Ukrainian troops in Konstantinovka, we have a discussion about this from our old friend Marochko and I believe Pushilin as well. But it looks as if the Russians are now sending more forces to the north of Konstantinovka. I get the sense that they're trying to trap Ukrainian forces in Konstantinovka and that they're trying to create some kind of a cauldron for the Ukrainians in Konstantinovka as well. And further north, around Slavyansk, the Russian advance continues at a rapid rate, certainly in terms of this war. But the Russians, perhaps more interestingly, also seem to be working towards resuming their offensive, the offensive they had in the summer, towards the city of Sumy itself. And there was a long article about all of this in Radovka, the Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, that covers the war very precisely. It says that once the Russians capture all of the string of villages that they're now attacking north of Sumy, there is a forest between the Russians and the city of Sumy. Far from the forest being an obstacle, it is ideal for building up forces undercover in order to attack, to prepare an attack on Sumy. If Sumy is attacked, if it is captured, not only will this be an important regional capital, but as I've discussed many times, it will open the route to Kiev. Anyway, let's now briefly finish this programme by a discussion of the situation in Britain, because there's been some very, very interesting developments. And once again, it looks as if Prime Minister Starmer is at the centre of them. And it is starting to look increasingly as if he's starting to take extraordinary risks in terms of legal and constitutional practice in order to preserve his position as Britain's Prime Minister. Now, the starting point of all of this is a debate that took place about 2 weeks ago in the British Parliament, over the course of which Starmer was obliged to agree that all documents related to the appointment of Peter Mandelson, Jeffrey Epstein's friend, and the man who ultimately made Starmer Prime Minister. Anyway, that all the documents related to Mandelson's appointment as British ambassador to the United States would be released. Now, about a week ago, 10 days ago, I said in a programme that the resignation letter of Starmer's chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, strongly suggested to me that there was information in these documents that would be extremely damaging to Keir Starmer and which he would be unlikely to survive. Well, consider what has happened over the last couple of days. Now, here I have to be extremely careful because the law in Britain on these issues, the law of contempt, is very, very rigorous. And I'm going to have to speak, as I said, using very, very careful words. But firstly, last week, we had the completely unexpected arrest of Andrew, the former prince, who obviously was a friend of Epstein's and who is, like Mandelson, being investigated for the crime of misconduct of public office because he apparently leaked important documents and papers to Jeffrey Epstein. Now, I said that I was, at the time, I was very surprised about this. It didn't really make sense to me. I didn't see why Andrew had to be arrested at all. More often, a person like Andrew, investigated for that kind of crime, would be called into a police interview first. And besides, it seemed to me that the arrest and detention of Andrew was difficult to explain, given that the same thing was not being done to Peter Mandelson, who was being investigated for the same crime. except that the facts of the crime seem to be, or of the alleged crime, seem to be much clearer in Mandelson's case, and the case against Mandelson seemed to me to be much stronger. And I wondered why Mandelson was being treated so much more leniently than Andrew was. And after I said that, perhaps by chance, most probably by chance, a whole lot of other people also said the same thing. And then Mandelson himself was arrested. And I assumed that he had been arrested because of the complaint, the outcry, that following Andrew's arrest and detention, Mandelson, against whom, as I said, the case seems much stronger, was being treated much more leniently. And then yesterday, things began to become very interesting. Firstly, the Prime Minister Keir Starmer said that he was not going to release all the documents about Mandelson's appointment to the position of British ambassador to the United States. After all, going back on his promise that he had made to Parliament, because he said that releasing all of those papers would interfere with the police investigation of Mandelson. Now, as a matter of constitution and law, I actually believe that is wrong. I think that Parliament has the absolute right to see whatever papers it wishes. It is not for the police to interfere with Parliament's right, if I may say so. And it is certainly not for the Prime Minister to make that kind of decision, going against not just Parliament's express wish, but the Prime Minister's own promise to Parliament to release all of the papers to Parliament. But anyway, that is what Starmer said, that he would hold some of the papers back after all. And then Mandelson's lawyers said that, in fact, there was no reason to arrest Mandelson at all, that the reason that Mandelson was arrested was because there'd been a tip-off to the police that Mandelson was intending to flee to the British Virgin Islands, and that this tip-off came from a very senior official in Parliament, and that the claim that Mandelson was intending to flee the country to the British Virgin Islands, which, by the way, has an extradition agreement with Britain, that was completely untrue anyway, and that Mandelson, far from wanting to flee or intending to flee, had actually agreed to meet the police on the 7th of March, using the procedure of agreeing to a police interview that I've discussed in previous programmes. Now, that was extraordinary in itself. But then, a few hours later, and after massive speculation in the media, and in particular a very interesting report in the London Times, the Speaker of the House of Commons, the most important figure in Parliament, the King's representative in the House of Commons, by the way, Lindsay Hoyle, came out and said that what Mandelson's lawyers were saying was actually true. He, Hoyle, had visited the British Virgin Islands. He'd been told there that there were rumours that Mandelson was intending to flee to the British Virgin Islands, and that it was he, Hoyle, who tipped off the police about Mandelson perhaps fleeing to the British Virgin Islands. And it was this, of course, which led to Mandelson's arrest. Now, here is where I have to be especially careful, because of the many protections under British law that the Speaker, who holds one of the highest offices in Britain, has. But suffice to say that there have been complaints in the past, notably from the Scottish National Party, that Lindsay Hoyle, the Speaker, is very close to Keir Starmer. Anyway, all very interesting. An arrest that didn't need to happen, following upon another arrest, that of Andrew, which also didn't need to happen. All leading to a statement by the Prime Minister, the documents that he had initially intended to provide to Parliament, which his former Chief of Staff, in my opinion, had hinted, clearly hinted, might contain information, which, shall we say, would not be to the Prime Minister's advantage. Anyway, that those documents would not be released to the Parliament, after all, because of an unnecessary arrest instigated by a tip-off from the Speaker, who is an individual who at a certain point in the past, not the very remote past, has been alleged to have a certain closeness to the Prime Minister, to Keir Starmer himself. As I said, I have to be very, very careful how I phrase this, and I apologise for any complexities of language. I'm getting the sense, though, that this is turning out to be a very, very big scandal indeed. It might be interesting to watch what Mandelson himself has to say over the next few days. It seems to me that all sorts of very strange things are taking place, which may lead to certain, shall we say, rather troubling conclusions. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you all that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. Please remember that you can also support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.